you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Appreciate it. Thanks. Thank you. Thank you. Well, I'm really honored to be here. And when I look across a crowd like this, I wish I were doing the introducing of the speaker and then I could leave and not have to worry about it. That's really the feeling you get. I don't know what it is. The longer the years go on, the more terrifying this calling actually becomes. It doesn't become any easier. Dr. Kluver was telling me he's in the Department of Communication here at the university, and he says how rapidly communication as a discipline is changing, that even after they complete a book, it has actually become outdated. And with that exponential growth in knowledge and the speed of dissemination and all kinds of issues that confront us, it's hard to really keep abreast of everything that is going on. But the truth of the matter is, you are here because you believe in the value of the subject, and out of courtesy, you're here to give an interactive time. I look forward to that time of interaction with you. Dr. Nabil Qureshi, as Dr. Kluver has said, will be joining me in the Q&A time. We are talking tonight about this whole issue of God or no God, and the issue of search for absolutes, especially in the realm of meaning and moral reasoning. The fact is that the question has been debated for many, many decades, if not centuries. It was the German philosopher Nietzsche who really popularized the phrase that God had died in the 19th century. But he also went on to say that because God had died in the 19th century, the 20th century would become the bloodiest century in history. But before I begin, I want to at least posit one important comment, and that's mainly because so often the debate can get wrong-headed in these matters when caricatures are made of either of the two disciplines from naturalism vis-a-vis theism. Where the naturalist tries to explain everything from a naturalistic viewpoint, and for the theist who does that explanation from a transcendent perspective of a personal, moral, intelligent first cause. Many times in that debate, paper tigers are made of the other situation and then done away with, and it's really not that good or intelligent argument. Here's a man by the name of David Berlinsky. Many of you may have heard of him. Berlinsky, well-known scientist, an agnostic, a skeptic in fact, reacted rather strongly to Richard Dawkins's book, The God Delusion. He was not the only atheistic scientist to react that way. Many others did as well. Philosopher Michael Ruse actually commented on Dawkins's approach as sort of giving the atheists a bad name. But here's David Berlinsky in his book, The Devil's Delusion, responding to Richard Dawkins. And in the flap portion of the cover of the book, he has these words. Has anyone provided a proof of God's inexistence? Not even close. Has quantum cosmology explained the emergence of the universe or why it is here? Not even close. Have the sciences explained why our universe seems to be fine-tuned to allow for the existence of life? Not even close. Are physicists and biologists willing to believe in anything so long as it is not religious thought? Close enough. Has rationalism and moral thought provided us with an understanding of what is good, what is right, and what is moral? Not close enough. Has secularism in the terrible 20th century been a force for good? Not even close to being close. Is there a narrow and oppressive orthodoxy of thought and opinion within the sciences? Close enough. Does anything in the sciences or in their philosophy justify the claim that religious belief is irrational? Not even in the ballpark. Is scientific atheism a frivolous exercise in intellectual contempt? Dead on. Now this is Berlinsky. He has got no axe to grind for the theist. In fact, in his book, he makes it clear that is not the perspective from which he is coming. And he talks very clearly about his agnosticism and skepticism and doesn't know where it is all headed. But he is clearly addressing this issue of false lines that are being created between the two. It was Galileo who made the comment. He said, the Bible is really a book about how to go to heaven, not about how the heavens go. And when centuries ago, thinkers can make those comments and remind us of the
barriers and the boundaries of the disciplines, it is important for us to keep that in mind. Michael Polanyi wrote a powerful book years ago. It was required reading for us at Cambridge, and it was called Personal Knowledge. Again, a warning that the disciplines had to honor their boundaries. But the question before us is the question of God or no God, the search for absolutes. My book, Can Man Live Without God, which was penned in the middle of the 90s after a series of lectures with the Harvard Law School being the venue, the first in the Veritas series, I built the title of the book, Can Man Live Without God, based on Will Durant's famous comment. He said, the greatest question of our time is not going to be East versus West, North versus South, capitalism versus Marxism. Those are not going to be the questions. He said, the greatest question of our time is going to be, can man live without God? And yet, how we struggle with that issue in this very day and this very time. In fact, it is becoming quite fashionable, in some academic circles at least, to mock that belief. The interesting thing is, I've done a lot of work in the Middle East and the Far East. I have never, ever seen a student or a faculty member there stand up and stridently or mockingly attack a theistic framework. They are much more prone to ask the question, which theistic framework do you go to? How do you defend the reality of this person you call God? It is fascinating to look back over the last little over a year when Richard Dawkins was on BBC debating Giles Fraser, interacting with him, the former dean of St. Paul's, and Dawkins in his usual flamboyant style was mocking Christianity. He's a bit of an intellectual coward, really. He daren't mock some of the other religious worldviews because he knows it may well be a farewell speech that he is making. But he will mock Christianity. And in the middle of his tirade, he was discussing a survey that had just been conducted amongst Christian audiences, some of whom couldn't name the four Gospels. So Giles Fraser looked at Dawkins and he said, Richard, your Bible is The Origin of Species by Darwin, isn't it? He said, that is correct. That's my sacred book. He said, all right, Richard, can you name the full title of the book? He said, yeah, I know, it's a longer title. He said, go ahead, name it. Now, I'm giving you verbatim Dawkins' answer. He said, the origin of the species, oh my God, for the life of me, I can't think of the rest of it. It goes by much longer than that, he said. How ironic that even an atheist had to call upon God to remind him of the title, to remind him of the title that caused him to disbelieve in him. That's what you call ultimate poetic justice. The next day, the British news ran taken place. All that aside, here are the words of Friedrich Nietzsche, born 1844, died 1900. And I think they're powerful. We have to listen to exactly what it is he's saying here. Makes it very clear what his end game is. The parable of the madman. Have you not heard of that madman who lit a lantern in the bright morning hours, ran to the marketplace and cried incessantly, I'm looking for God, I'm looking for God. As many of those who did not believe in God were standing together there, he excited considerable laughter. Have you lost him then, said one. Did he lose his way like a child, said another. Maybe he is hiding. Is he afraid of us? Has he gone on a voyage or emigrated? Thus they shouted and laughed him to scorn. But the madman sprang into their midst and pierced them with his glances. Where is God? He cried. I'll tell you, we have killed him, you and I. We're all his murderers. But how did we do this? How were we able to drink up the sea? Who gave us a sponge to wipe away the entire horizon? What did we do when we unchained this earth from its sun? Whither is it moving now? Whither are we moving now? Away from all suns, maybe? Are we not perpetually falling backwards, forwards, sidewards, in all directions? Is there any up or down left? Are we not straying through an infinite nothing? Do we not feel the breath of empty space? Has it not suddenly become colder? Is not more and more night coming on us all the time? Must not lanterns now have to be lit in the morning hours? Do we not hear anything of the noise of the grave diggers who are burying God? Do we not smell anything yet of God's decomposition? God's decomposed too, you know, and he is dead. God remains dead, and we have killed him. Now, how shall we, the murderer of all murderers, compose ourselves? Because that which was the holiest and mightiest of all that the world had possessed has bled to death under our knives. Who will wipe this blood from us? With what water can we purify ourselves? What festivals of atonement, what sacred games will we need to invent? Is this not the greatest deed of all deeds? Too great for us, maybe. Must we not ourselves now become God? Simply to seem worthy of it. There's never been a greater deed, you know, and whoever shall be born after us for the sake of this deed shall be part of a higher history than all of history hitherto. The madman then fell silent and regarded his listeners. They too were silent, and they stared at him in astonishment. At last he threw his lantern to the ground, and it broke and went out. I come too early. Maybe my time has not yet come. It has been related further that on the same day the madman entered diverse churches and there sang a requiem, Aeternum Deo. Let out and quieted, he said to have retorted each time, what are these churches now if they are not the tombs and sepulchres of God who is dead? We have killed him. A very powerful set of questions. Is there any up or down left? Must we not now have lanterns to be lit in the morning hours? Who gave us a sponge to wipe away the entire horizon? You know, these philosophers were cautious, even though they were confident in their belief, they were cautious about the ramifications. They knew the entailments were going to be extraordinary and could ultimately result in the very decimation of man. I think this afternoon as I was studying, my mind went back to Alexander Solzhenitsyn, now long passed away. It was Solzhenitsyn when he was speaking at Harvard and talked. His talk was a world split apart. He made a comment. He said, when I was a little boy, I remember in my home in the former Soviet Union, watching my grandfather in a dimly lit room sitting around the table with my parents and family. And there would be somber tones and a sadness about it all. And the discussions would be going on of all the horrors that were striking their land as millions had been exterminated. My thought went back to him today, thinking of what's going on to the poor Ukrainian people as tanks are rumbling through their streets now. Solzhenitsyn made this comment. He said, however it all went through the night, at the end, it would be coming to an end when my grandfather would stand up at the table and make this comment. All of this, he said, is happening to us because we have forgotten God. We have forgotten God. And Solzhenitsyn told those prestigious audiences, he said, I'm an old man now. I have read tens of thousands of pages, and I have written thousands of pages myself, and I have come to the same conclusion my grandfather came to. The West is on the verge of collapse created by her own hands, because between good and evil there's an irreconcilable contradiction, he said. And when we've forgotten God, there go the absolutes as well. Contrarily, listen to the words of Arthur Schlesinger speaking at Brown University at their graduation some years ago. The mystic prophets of the absolute simply cannot save us. Sustained by our own history and traditions, we must save ourselves at whatever risk of heresy or blasphemy. We can find solace in the memorable representation of the human struggle against the absolute, in the finest scene in the greatest American novels. I refer, of course, to the scene when Huckleberry Finn decides that, quote, the plain hand of Providence requires him to tell Miss Watson where her runaway slave Jim is to be found. Huck writes his letter of betrayal to Miss Watson and feels all washed and clean of sin for the first time I had ever felt so in my life, and I knowed I could pray now. He sits there for a while thinking how good it was all this happened so, and how near I come to being lost and going to hell. Then Huck begins to think about Jim and the rush of the great river and the talking and the singing and the laughing and the friendship. Then I happened to look around and I seized that paper and I took it up and held it in my hand. And I was a trembling because I'd got to decide forever betwixt two things. And I knowed it. I studied it a minute, sort of holding my breath, and then says to myself, all right, then I'll go to hell, and tore it up. Schlesinger adds this line, that, if I may say so, is what America is all about. That, if I may say so, is what America is all about. Never pausing long enough to ask the question, was the situation that he represented in the points of tension not really a creation of the fact that the absolutes had already been forgotten? That's what brought about the predicament in the first place. Now, all of a sudden, on the heels of a relativistic end, relativism goes on and on and on and gets to a point where there is no point of reference for relativism on its own. Relative to what? To whom? At what time? In what place? And so the search for absolutes. The four issues that come crashing down if we forget God is the struggle to find a moral point of reference. Where do we turn for this moral point of reference? Who dictates this for us? Why do we make our choices? What are the absolutes? You know, I've been an itinerant now for 4 decades, and there are landmark moments in my life where I recall going back either to my room where I was staying or in a hotel room where I was staying, and sitting down at my desk and making notes on what all had just happened that day and that night, and reflecting on how I myself was being changed in my thinking in the process. In my middle 20s, while I was an undergraduate student in Toronto, I'd been invited to Vietnam to speak to the troops, to the American troops, to the Korean troops, and the Australians, and many others. I went from military base to military base, courtesy of the American helicopter gunships and all that ferreted me and my interpreter around. I was in my 20s, just starting out. I remember coming back night after night when even the lights were out and trying under flashlight to write my thoughts. My life was changing before my own eyes with what I had seen. But nothing as dramatic had ever happened to me as in the 1980s when I'd been invited to lecture in the universities in Poland. And my host was a man who had taken me to where I was speaking, one particular town, and he asked me one day on a free day, would you be open to going to see Auschwitz? And I told him I'd already seen some concentration camps. He said, no, Ravi, this is not a concentration camp. This is a death camp. You must see it. So he put me into his car and we drove on this cold, cloudy day. The Cold War was still raging at that time. I was not emotionally prepared for what I was about to see. And as we pulled up outside Auschwitz and walked through that horrible-looking place with so many memories of all the deaths that had taken place, I walked from room to room, and I noticed in the handful of people there, from adults and young people, not one word was spoken by anybody to anybody. There was a pin drop, deadly silence. The pictures were doing the talking. One room with children and their children's pictures and their suitcases and their toothbrushes and their clothes, and the boys of the pictures of twins experimented upon by Joseph Mengele as they were castrated, standing there at attention, looking nothing more than a sack of bones with an eye gaze that defied anything you could imagine. They looked like they were already dead on the inside. How a surgeon, an intellectual, an intelligent man, could have done what he did to these little children defies an imagination. I walked out of there stunned, and then just before you entered the room with the gas ovens, there was a statement by Adolf Hitler that said it all. I want to raise a generation of young people devoid of a conscience, imperious, relentless, and cruel. Paul Johnson, in his book Modern Times, draws a connection between Nietzschean ideas and Hitler's Holocaust. And he says how Adolf Hitler personally presented the writings of Nietzsche to Stalin and to Mussolini. And the whole idea of the Übermensch, the Superman, Listen to how Nietzsche sustained this in his own writings. Listen carefully, please. It flies in the face of everything you and I believe here in this land. He says this, equality is a lie. It's a lie concocted by inferior people who arrange themselves in herds to overpower those who are naturally superior to them. The morality of equal rights is a herd morality because it opposes the cultivation of superior individuals. It leads to the corruption of the human species. The real truth about objective truth is that the latter is a fiction. Every candidate for truth must first be expressed in a language, and language is notoriously unable to get us to reality. Words, like a hall of mirrors, reflect only each other and in the end point back to the conditions of their users without having to establish anything about the way things really are. Truth is the name we give to that which agrees with our instinctives and our preferences. It is what we call our interpretation of the world, especially when we want to foist it upon others. But then he goes and says, but even I am still too pious so that even I worship at the altar where God's name is truth. Equality is a lie concocted by inferior people. Anyone who has studied the history of the Olympics will remember how Hitler reacted when Jesse Owens screamed the opposition and was winning medal after medal after medal. His theory of the Superman was falling on its face as he walked out of the arena, unable to contain the fact that the best of his own were beaten. This is the ramification of what Nietzsche was really talking about when he said, say, that equality is a farcical thing that is concocted by the human mind in our own imagination and generally done by inferior people. Ladies and gentlemen, if you were to read the whole story of the way the Holocaust went and how it ultimately ended, I was involved in a lot of research after Eichmann's trial had been held, and I was actually in Yad Vashem doing some research at that time and picked up an awful lot of information. And Hannah Arendt writes this about the trial of Adolf Eichmann at the end, and this is the conclusion I want to draw for you. She says this in the end of her book. Adolf Eichmann went to the gallows with great dignity. He had asked for a bottle of red wine and had drunk half of it. He refused the help of the Protestant minister, the Reverend William Hull, who offered to read the Bible to him. He had only 2 more hours to live, and therefore, quote, he said, "I have no time to waste." He walked the 50 yards from his cell to the execution chamber, calm and erect, with his hands bound behind him. When the guards tied his ankles and knees, he asked them to loosen the bonds so that he could stand straight. "I don't need that," he said, when the black hood was offered to him. He was in complete command of himself. Nay, he was more. He was really completely himself. Nothing could have demonstrated this more convincingly than the grotesque silliness of his last words. He began by stating emphatically that he was not a believer in God, that he was no Christian, and did not believe in life after death. He then proceeded, "After a short while, gentlemen, we shall all meet again. This is the fate of all men. Long live Germany, long live Argentina, long live Austria. I shall not forget them." In the face of death, he found the cliché used in his funeral oratory. Under the gallows, his memory played him the last trick. He was elated, and he forgot that this was actually his own funeral. It was as though, listen to Hannah Arendt's words here, please. It was as though in those last minutes, he was summing up the lesson that this long course in human wickedness has taught us, the lesson of the fearsome word and thought-defying banality of evil. The lesson of fearsome word and thought-defying banality of evil. When I had the privilege of being with Malcolm Muggeridge just shortly before he passed away in England, it was one of my dreams in life to meet Mr. Muggeridge. I loved the way he turned a phrase. I loved all of his books, and he was a late comer to Christ himself. And that afternoon, as we'd had a simple plowman's lunch of some crusty bread and cheese, we talked about all of his years and his own pilgrimage as editor of Punch magazine, mocking things and making fun of even religious things, to his ultimate conversion and his following of the path of Christ as his wife and his son and I were sitting having lunch. Then he got up, walked and showed me around. And Muggeridge told me this story, sustained historically again by Paul Johnson, the historian, and confirmed over the BBC when Svetlana Stalin, the daughter of Joseph Stalin, told the story. She said, I could never figure out my father. Not a big man. But as he turned his back on all these things sacred and so on, what actually happened was Stalin was a one-time seminary student going into the ministry. Then he lost his faith in God. And as he took over the reins, even Lenin voiced deep concern over the extremes to which this man would possibly go. And after having exterminated 15 million of his own people, two things happened. In the middle of that, a Western political leader came up to him and said, Mr. Stalin, I want to ask you a question. You are killing your own people by the tens of thousands. You're torturing them. How long do you plan to keep doing this? Stalin never answered her. He called a waiter, and he asked the waiter to bring a live chicken. And he took the live chicken and in front of his guests started to defeather that bird. Denuded it, put it down, and walked away with a piece of bread in his hand. The chicken hobbled over, nuzzled between his trouser legs. He bent down with a piece of bread to the chicken as it started to peck away at it. And he looked at his guest. He said, do you get your answer, ma'am? He said, I tortured this chicken. It'll follow me for food the rest of its life. People are like that chicken. You torture them, and they will follow you for food the rest of their lives. You see, the definition of what it means to be human suddenly becomes murky, suddenly becomes blurred, because there is no ontic referent of an essential worth or a reflective splendor. And Svetlana said this to the BBC commentator. She said, I'll never forget the last thing my father did. It was the last physical act. He was lying in bed hallucinating. Suddenly he sat up, and he clenched his fist towards the heavens one more time, threw his head back on the pillow, and he was gone. At the Center for Geopolitical Strategy in Moscow, where I had the privilege of addressing the entire faculty, which was atheistic, the general had taken me out and asked me some questions, and I'd answered him and told him this story. The head of the department of the entire faculty of the Center for Geopolitical Strategy in Moscow, 8 stories above ground, 4 stories below ground, all of their leaders have graduated from there. As they lined up, first had been hostile, they shook the hand of my colleague, kissed the back of my wife's hand, and then he grabbed mine, and here's what he said. Mr. Zacharias, your defense of God today, I believe, is the truth, but it's very difficult to change after 70 years of believing a lie. That was his goodbye to me. America has been a great nation, is a great nation, and one of its great values, said Alexis de Tocqueville, is because the greatness of her faith and her spiritual values. And I want to say to you, ladies and gentlemen, if you're really looking for absolutes, and you and I turn our back against God, where are we going to find it? I know Sam Harris and all make valiant efforts from evolutionary morality to well-being and all of that. Not a single new argument under the sun from them. 7 different kinds of humanism emerge, each of which in conflict with the other, looking for an ontic referent of what life's value ought to be. Morality goes. Secondly, the quest for meaning. What is it that really gives life meaning? We find it in so many different ways. We find it in our relationships. We find it in our loves. We find it in our accomplishments. We find it in the accolades that are showered upon us. And yet sometimes you find people with the greatest number of accomplishments end up actually being very, very lonely on the inside. I remember being at the home of a man in Hong Kong who was the 7th wealthiest man in the world, who'd invited me to speak to what he called the Diamond Collar Group in Hong Kong. And the first night, we're sitting around a table, and I look at him and I say to him, why did you make the decision you did to follow God, to give your life to Jesus Christ. How did this happen? And he looked at me and he said, Ravi, some time ago I was sitting at the top of the building that we own, and I was sitting up there and I thought to myself, why am I so empty on the inside? So I get on the phone and I phone my wife and I say to her, I don't know if you feel the things I do. We have everything we've ever wanted, but I'm a terribly lonely man. She said, so am I. What do we do? She said, let's go to church. He said, do they have church on Wednesday night? She said, I don't know, but let's go. He said, where? She said, let's go to the one opposite one of our apartment buildings. Then we won't have to pay for parking. We can park in our apartment building. And they arrive there, and their journey to faith ultimately begins. So here's what I want to say to you. What gives life meaning? How do we find meaning in life? We talk about it as if it's something tangible. I've given it a lot of thought, and I've concluded that when you look for meaning, there needs to be a confluence of four realities in a person's life. One is the sense of wonder, the enormous sense of enchantment, that sense of wonder that a baby has, that a child has, that looks even at the simplest contraption and stays in awe, or that stares into the mother's face and wants to say so much but can't, but the eyes tell the story, the smile tells the story. I'll never forget some years ago crossing over from Amman, Jordan, through the Allenby Bridge across into Israel. The lineups used to be long and torturous. You could spend hours waiting to be quizzed. It was my wife, my 2.5-year-old daughter, Sarah, and we were with our bags moving inch by inch. The bags are brought halfway by the Jordanian porter across the Allenby Bridge. The Israeli porter comes halfway, picks it up, takes you, and then you stand in line. And we're getting weary holding this little one with a lot of people still in front of us. And my daughter, Sarah, with her olive complexion, being held in my wife's arms and then my arms, all of a sudden, totally out of the blue, she bursts out with this line, looking at an Israeli soldier, armed to the teeth. She says to him, excuse me, sir, do you have any bubble gum? You're just surrounded by these boys with their machine guns. Do you know what he did? My wife's Canadian, I'm from India. We have this beautiful olive-complected little girl in our arms. He takes his weapons and gives it to another soldier. And he comes over towards us and puts his arms out. And Sarah goes over to him. He takes Sarah into a back room. And he was there for a few minutes, and now I'm beginning to have kittens over this whole thing. So what's happening here? He comes out holding her in one arm, a tray in the other with three glasses of lemonade, one for my wife, one for Sarah, one for me, moved us to the front of the line, got us through, put us in his Jeep, and drove us to the nearest taxi stand as we made our way on to Jericho. A little child caused the war to stop in the mind of a man because he was looking into the eyes of one filled with wonder. The Bible talks about this. How through the lips of infants he has ordained praise. That sense of wonder, enchantment, the fairy tale stories through which we come, which hold us in awe. My 2.5-year-old grandson's most common statement, Papa, tell me a story. Tell me a story. And he'll just sit there glaring at you with his eyes getting wide. Tell me a story, the enchantment. But you know, after some time, you have to move beyond the enchanting alone, not the fantastic alone. You have to find out that which is fantastically true. Not just fantastic, but fantastically true. And the awesome capacity that God has given to the human mind. Even this very week, all that was registered with the gravitational waves that Einstein predicted so long ago would be discovered and found from the Bang 13.5 billion years ago and so on. All this spectacular stuff that produces the great minds that give you and me this immense capacity to think rationally, to think with rational inference, to think with the law of non-contradiction. I've suffered from back problems for many, many years and have two titanium rods bracketing me from L3 down to S1 with 8 screws bolting me down. With all of our capacity, with all of our enchantment, with all of our technology, we still cannot replicate the spinal column. We still don't know the mystery and marvel of the eye. And that's when we have to step back, take a step back, and say how fearfully and wonderfully we have actually been made at the hands of an extraordinary creator. One who has this infinite wisdom and capacity. Wonder, truth, third is love. The majesty of love. The beauty of love. When my father-in-law passed away at the age of 85, his last words, after being silent for a couple of days, he opened his eyes, looked at his wife of 60 plus years, and said, "Jean, I love you." And he was gone. My mother-in-law is still alive at the age of 95 or 96. She treasures those 60 some years of a devoted heart and the final goodbye that affirmed and honored her pristine and unique worth in the eyes of this one person alone. Augustine says, "You made us for yourself, and our hearts are restless until they find their rest in thee." Meaning, wonder, truth, love, and security. Those are the components that bring meaning to life. Without the absolute of a transcendent perspective, there is ultimately no moral law. Secondly, there is no point of reference that you can find for meaning. And thirdly, there is really no hope beyond the grave. No hope beyond the grave. We have to realize, it's what Nicholas Walterstorff said so powerfully, this great professor from Yale who has endured a fair bit of tragedy in his own life. He made this comment not too long ago, and I want to read this for you. And I think it is a brilliant comment. Here's what he said. Please listen. "When we have overcome absence with phone calls, winglessness with airplanes, summer heat with air conditioning, when we have overcome all of these and much more besides, then there will abide two things with which we must cope: the evil in our hearts and death." The evil in our hearts and death. "And all these other bridges have been conquered. I'm coming here straight from Newtown, Connecticut. Need I say more? And the first night we arrive, we drive past the fire station where there are 26 stars above the roof of the fire station. How do you speak to an audience like that, that has gone through what they did with 23 little ones slaughtered mercilessly, and 3 adults as well? They had phoned me actually immediately after it happened, and I said, you know, I had the privilege of being in Columbine after it happened, and Virginia Tech as well, and I said the same thing to them I'm saying to you. Give time a little working room here till some natural healing takes place. I said, give me a year and I will be there. And so the year comes and we are there. What are the two questions they're looking at? How does a carnage like this take place and evil like this get manifested, where a 20-year-old comes and slaughters the innocent? What do you say to a father or mother that's lost a little one? And I just say to you, Jesus himself understood this very well. When he comes into Bethany to the home of his friends, Mary and Martha and Lazarus, and they're looking at him and saying, you know, if you'd really been here a little while before, you could have prevented this from happening. And he says, you know, I am the resurrection and the life. They say, we understand that. But if you'd come here earlier, you could have prevented this from happening. Jesus does the most amazing thing, I think, in the gospel narrative here. He walks up to the tomb and he realizes his friend Lazarus is dead and he weeps. You know, if this was some manufactured story, there would have been a cavalier attitude towards all of this. Oh, what are you guys weeping over? Don't you know I can do all of this? He weeps because he understands the weight of the loss human beings feel at the loss of a loved one, even though the truth of the resurrection pertained, and he raised him knowing the day would still come where he dies. In fact, Lazarus's grave is now in Cyprus, and it's very briefly written there, Lazarus, Bishop of Larnaca, twice dead, friend of Jesus, twice dead, friend of Jesus. Billy Graham was telling us, a group around a table once, he said one of the most memorable conversations he ever had was in Germany after the war and all of the tragedy. He said, I was in the office of Konrad Adenauer. And he said, Mr. Adenauer was pacing the floor talking about him, about all the tragedy that he had inherited and the sadness of what had happened. And then he said, he walked over to a window and he said, I'm behind him. And he says, looking out of the window, he says, Mr. Graham, I have a question for you. Do you really believe that Jesus Christ rose again from the dead? Do you really believe that? Billy Graham said, I was shocked, coming from a man of his stature. He said, Mr. Adenauer, if I didn't believe in the resurrection of Jesus Christ, he said, I would have no gospel left to be preached. He said, Konrad Adenauer walked around and then looked him in the eyes and he said, Mr. Graham, I want to tell you something that I believe. Outside of the resurrection of Jesus Christ, I know of no other hope for mankind. Outside of the resurrection of Jesus Christ, I know of no other hope for mankind. The paradigm from the eternal perspective that tells you life is not just lived in its 70 years and 10, that there is a hope, that there is life beyond the grave. If I didn't have that firm belief, having buried my parents so early in life, it would only intensify the sadness and intensify the hopelessness. The hope that Christ gives is a down payment that you and I get in this moment, that life has that eternal perspective. That's what Solomon said. God has put eternity into the hearts of men. That hope that God gives, that promise of the resurrection from the dead, that is the point of reference from which all else can ultimately be explained. Let me give you just 3 sustaining points in this. And one caveat here. The Bible is such an incredibly honest book. When Jesus is asked by his disciples, I remember the first time reading it as a young convert. I put the Bible down and I thought to myself, what on earth is happening here? The disciples look at him and say, when are you going to return? When are you going to return? If Jesus were a charlatan, if he were a fake kind of a Messiah, do you know what he would have said? He would have said, I'm not going to tell you. That's exactly what he said. I'm going to keep you in that mystery. Instead, he says, of that hour knows no man, not even the Son of Man. In that emptying of his own prerogatives, he said he did not know the hour to give to the disciple who asked him. If Jesus were fake, he would never have made that statement. He would have just given some unfalsifiable claim like, few thousand years from now, or I'm not going to tell you. So he said, of that hour no man knows, not even the Son of Man. The conversion of 3 dramatically involved individuals. Number one, Saul of Tarsus to the Apostle Paul. Saul of Tarsus to the Apostle Paul. I remember being at the office of the chief intelligence officer in Damascus, not far from the wall. And he brought me in to interrogate me and tell me he knew exactly who I was and that they were going to track me through my trip in Syria. I said, that's fine. I'm aware of it. And then he says, just don't get involved in our politics and you'll be fine, Mrs. Zacharias. He said, we welcome you here. We need you here. I said, thank you, sir. And then he leans forward and says, this is where it all began, you know. I said, not quite, a few miles up the road, but this is where it continued. And we shook hands with some baklava and coffee, and I left. Saul of Tarsus, his conversion to write 1/3 of the New Testament, that dramatic change. Number 2, Thomas, who said, I'm not going to believe until I reach out, see, and feel. What did Thomas do? He went to India, and the oldest church in India is named after him, the Martoma Church, as he arrived there and proclaimed the gospel and paid with his life. And the conversion of James, the brother of Jesus as well. Those three dramatic conversions, apart from the hundreds that saw the resurrection. I say to you, with God, there is moral capacity of definition, there is meaning, there is hope, and finally I say to you, if there is no God, what hope is there for the transformation of the human heart and the redemption message that you and I really need? I want to close with two quotes. One comes from the world of rock music, one comes from a journalist who's a skeptic, which is fascinating. Andrew Fletcher, the Scottish political activist, said, "Let me write the songs of a nation. I don't care who writes its laws." My work at Cambridge University was in the Romantic poets, because I believe the poets will oftentimes reflect reality much more readily than those who can hide oftentimes under the cerebrally driven abstract structure of philosophy and so on. So studying these Romantic poets taught me so much. But go back to our own poets in our time. King Crimson put it in these words: "Cat's foot, iron claw, neurosurgeons scream for more. From paranoia's poison door, 21st century schizoid man. Blood rack, barbed wire, politicians, funeral pyre. Innocence raped with napalm fire, 21st century schizoid man. Death seed, blind man's greed, poets starving, children bleed. Nothing he's got, he really needs, 21st century schizoid man. The walls on which the prophets wrote is cracking at the seams. Upon the instruments of death, the sunlight brightly gleams. Will no one lay the laurel wreath as silence drowns the screams? Between the iron gates of fate, the seeds of time are sown and watered by the deeds of those who know and who are known. Knowledge is a deadly friend when no one sets the rules. The fate of all mankind, I see, is in the hands of fools. Confusion will be my epitaph as I crawl a cracked and broken path. If we make it, we can all sit back and laugh. But I'm afraid tomorrow I'll be crying." What did he say? The walls on which the prophets wrote is cracking at the seams. Upon the instruments of death, the sunlight brightly gleams. Here is a skeptic, a man who amazed everybody by writing this article some years ago. One of my colleagues, John Jiroge from Kenya, sent this. He works with me in Atlanta. He sent this to me. And if you see this article, you quickly realize how amazing that this story is, coming from a man who lives in a lifestyle and a choice of life that he does not boast to be Christian. In fact, he says he's an atheist. And listen to this, and with this I close. It's a protracted series of paragraphs, but here's what he says. "Before Christmas, I returned after 45 years to the country that as a boy I knew as Nyasaland. Today it's Malawi. And the Times Christmas appeal includes a small British charity working there. Pump Aid helps rural communities to install a simple pump, letting people keep their village wells sealed and clean. I went to see this work. It inspired me, renewing my flagging faith in development charities. But traveling in Malawi refreshed another belief too, one I've been trying to banish all my life, but an observation I've been unable to avoid since my African childhood. It confounds my ideological beliefs, stubbornly refuses to fit my worldview, and has embarrassed my growing belief that there is no God. Now, as a confirmed atheist, I've become convinced of the enormous contribution that Christian evangelism makes in Africa, sharply distinct from the work of secular NGOs, government projects, and international aid efforts. These alone will not do. Education and training alone simply will not do. In Africa, Christianity changes people's hearts. It brings a spiritual transformation. This rebirth I have seen is real. The change is good. I have to tell you, I used to avoid this truth by applauding, as you can see, the practical work of mission churches in Africa. It's a pity. I would say that salvation is part of the package. But Christians, black and white, working in Africa, do heal the sick, do teach people to read and write, and only the severest kind of secularist could see a mission hospital or school and say the world would be better off without it. I would allow that if faith was needed to motivate missionaries to help them, fine. But what counted was the help, not the faith. But this no more fits the facts for me. Faith does more than support mission the missionary. It is also transferred to his flock. This is the effect that matters so immensely and which I really cannot help observing anymore. First, then, the observation. We had friends who were missionaries, and as a child, I stayed often with them. And he goes on and talks about the difference in their lives and so on. And then he talks about how he struggled with his own faith at an early stage. But this time in Malawi, I met no missionaries other than these. You do not encounter missionaries in the lobbies of expensive hotels discussing development strategy documents as you do with the big NGOs. But instead, I noticed that a handful of the most impressive African members of Pump Aid were privately strong Christians, privately because the charity is entirely secular, and I never heard anyone of its team so much as mention religion while working in the villages. But I picked up the Christian reference in our conversation. One I saw was studying a devotional textbook in the car. One on Sunday went off to church at dawn for a two-hour service. It would suit me to believe that their honesty, diligence, and optimism in their work was unconnected with personal faith, that their work was secular, but surely affected by what they were. What there was, in turn, influenced by a conception of man's place in the universe and Christianity had taught. You know, there's long been a fashion among Western academic sociologists for placing tribal value systems within a ring fence beyond critiques founded in our own culture and they and theirs, and therefore it's best for them, authentic and of intrinsically equal worth to ours. I don't follow this anymore. I observe that tribal belief is no more peaceable than ours and that it suppresses individuality. People think collectively, first in terms of community, extended family and tribe. This rural tradition mindset feeds into the big man and gangster politics of the African city, the exaggerated respect for a swaggering leader, and the literal inability to understand the whole idea of the loyal opposition. Anxiety, fear of evil spirits, ancestors of nature and of the wild and of tribal hierarchy, of quite everyday things, strikes deep into the whole structure of rural African thought. Every man has his place, and call it fear or respect, a great weight grinds down the individual spirit, stunting curiosity. People won't take the initiative, won't take things into their own hands or on their own shoulders. How can I, as someone with a foot in both camps, atheism and this now, explain this? And then he goes on to say this, to the rural African mind, this is an explanation of why would not climb the mountain, etc. He goes on, let me move to the last two paragraphs here. Christianity, post-Reformation and post-Martin Luther, with its teaching of a direct, personal, two-way link between the individual and God, unmediated by the collective and unsubordinate to any other human being, smashes straight through the philosophical, rich, spiritual framework I've just described. It offers something to hold on to those anxious to cast off a crushing tribal groupthink. That is why and how it liberates. Those who want Africa to walk tall amid 21st century global competition must not kid themselves that providing them with material means or even the know-how that accompanies what we call development will make the change. A whole belief system must first be supplanted. And I'm afraid it has to be supplanted by another. Removing Christian evangelism from the African equation may leave the continent at the mercy of a malign fusion of Nike, the witch doctor, the mobile phone, and the machete. It's amazing. Coming from Matthew Paris, that was amazing. May I close with a personal anecdote, friends? At the age of 17, I was a total failure in life. Total failure. No discipline, nothing. Never wanted to study, never wanted to crack open a book. I was always at the bottom of the class. I just wanted to do one thing, was play cricket. I want to play someday nationally, and even that I don't think I'd have made it, but I wanted to try. And one day I decided life had no meaning. The Sartrean caution was right. He said, the only question I cannot answer is why I don't commit suicide, but that would be to use my freedom to take away my freedom, says he. Well, I did try to commit suicide. No meaning. None. Zero. And in that hospital room, a Bible was brought to me. I couldn't hold it. My body was dehydrated with the poison and all the expelling that I'd done. This man comes and leaves the Bible. He wanted to stay. My mother wouldn't let him because I was in critical condition. He opens it to a page to her, and she is told to read it. She didn't understand it. Reading from a King James with a heavy South Indian accent. I'm lying in bed, and she reads this verse. Jesus says, "Because I live, you also shall live." In that hospital room, that statement came alive to me. Jesus is talking about what it really means to live, not biological life. And in a simple prayer that I prayed, I walked out of there. That was 50 years ago, almost to the day. What Christ did in my heart was not change what I did alone, but change what I wanted to do, to a point where my father, before he died, called me to his bedside to ask forgiveness for the meanness with which he had dealt with my life. And he looked at me and he said, "Son, I just want to say to you that God found it worthy somehow to dip into my family to take one of my boys to speak for him." And he just burst into sobs and tears. He said, "I want your forgiveness." You're young as students and you're looking for meaning. Without God, there's no point of reference for moral law. There's no point of reference for meaning. There's no hope beyond the grave. And ultimately, there's no real positing of a redemptive source for the transformation of life. And the problem is ultimately not out there, it's in here. And only God is big enough to change your heart and mind. I leave that with you, and we'll have some time now for questions. Thank you so much for giving me a hand.
Lovely, thank you. Thank you very much, Dr. Zacharias. It's a terrific talk. And now, of course, we've come to the part where everybody's waiting so they can ask very specific questions. So I'll invite you to make your way to the microphones. Would you like to introduce
Nabil Qureshi to you. He's this robust, good-looking 30-year-old. Nabil Qureshi is a medical doctor by profession. And late comer to Christ, came to know Christ about 7 years ago, comes from a Muslim background. His book has recently been released called Seeking Allah, Finding Jesus, in a dramatic story and dramatic conversion. He has since picked up a couple of degrees, one from Duke and one from Biola in biblical studies, and is on his way this fall to Oxford University to do his doctoral work. Nabil has joined our team. He's an impassioned young man, does a brilliant defense of the gospel. And I always travel with one of my younger colleagues. As there's more snow on the roof, I prefer to bring some younger-looking guys with me. We're going to take some turns or sometimes just complete an answer for you. I know you'll enjoy listening to Nabil, and he will share the platform with me.
Thank you. Terrific.
Yes, please welcome Nabil here, too.
If we can, I'd like to start with a question from the Twitter feed, and the first question is, in a sense, a bit of a follow-up to what you've already addressed, but William Bennett asked, "Can we not find a system of morality through scientific fact? What is good is what benefits humankind and individual humans."
Yes, of course, I think that's the only alternative we can have, but it is all value-laden. The answer is value-laden. What benefits humankind? Why are we all so terrified right now by the fact that a 777 airliner is missing? Why are we terrified about this? Not just for the 200-some lives, but what we are thinking about it, is there some sinister motive to have the means of transportation of some deadly weaponry that could inflict pain on thousands, if not millions, of people? Whether that scenario is true or not, who knows? We hope it is not true. But certainly, as the weapons of hatred pile up all over the world, the definition that Putin gives to what benefits people is very different to what we give that benefits people. It is a value-laden term of using terms of benefit. if there is no essential definition of who we are, the what becomes nothing more than choices between pragmatism, utilitarianism, existentialism, postmodernism, all the isms that emerge. Life is far too complex to just talk about benefiting mankind. I have talked to people who actually think that the West is an accursed culture and the world will be better off by removing the West. He or she thinks it will benefit mankind for the removal of that. So the ends justifies the means, and it's a case of no point of reference for the concept of benefit. It becomes a very narrow focus. So let me give you how the answer is in the biblical realm. The answer is this. I've often given this illustration. Moses had 613 laws. David reduced them to 15, Isaiah to 11, Micah to 3, to do justice, to love mercy, and to walk humbly before your God. Jesus did not reduce it to one. You would think it would be grand for him to reduce it to one. When he was asked which is the greatest commandment, his answer was fascinating. He said, to love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul and all your mind and all your strength, and to love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments hang all of the laws and the prophets. Why two? Because of the first, the second necessarily follows. Without the first, the second is with your feet firmly planted in midair. To love your neighbor as yourself, says who? How does one even define what love really means? And he anchored this in a brilliant interaction with a man who said to him, is it all right to pay taxes to Caesar? And as we approach April 15th, I often wish Jesus had answered this question differently. It'd be wonderful if he'd said, absolutely not. Then you can be rebellious and spiritual at the same time. Jesus said to him, give me a coin. And the man gave him a coin. He says, whose image do you see on you? On this, he said, Caesar. He said, give to Caesar that which is Caesar's, and give to God that which is God's. The man should have had a follow-up question. What belongs to God? And Jesus would have said, whose image is on you? You see? That's the compliment Christ gives to you and me. When his image is on you, I have no right to violate you. And hopefully the feelings would be mutual.
Thank you very much. Thank you. I think we'll go over here for a question.
All right. Thank you very much for letting me ask this question. And I'm sorry if I sound nervous, but I have a very large audience and... Never
a little
really...
clearer so we can hear you. Yep.
All right. So you said that the reason that we need God is because he establishes an absolute morality and that he gives meaning to life and the hope of life after death, that there's we have the potential to be saved eternally. But I'm not a religious person, and I never really have been. And I guess I have a question is why we need those things. Why do humans need an absolute morality? Why do we need a higher meaning in life other than the fact that just to exist? And why do we need hope in life after death? And I'd like to share a brief little story that kind of might give you some insight into my thought process here. So when I was little, I believed that Santa Claus existed because I didn't want to have my parents...
Privileged to be able to field this question. For one, I think you should have given a spoiler warning before the question, just in case there's anyone here who didn't get the memo, Santa Claus does not exist. Just got to throw that out there every now and then. You're absolutely right. Some people have brought up this issue to me before while we were in discussion. So what if there is no afterlife? So what if there is no hope to this life? So what if for after we die, there's oblivion? They see Christianity or religion or theism as potentially a kind of crutch to hold on to for those who can't handle the harsh truths of this world. But I think that there's far more to this picture to take into mind, and then we can see what the ramifications are for that perspective. For one, I think that there's a lot of questions that arise when you take God out of the equation. So, for example, I've been trained in medical school as a medical doctor. What I see when I look at the human body is one fascinating piece of machinery, if you look at it from a physiological perspective, that to me must be predicated on a designer. As I take a look at some aspects of the human body, for example, the eye, what is going on when you see something? When you see something, light is reflecting off an object, going from that object into your eye. Your lens then, all lenses do this, they take the image and invert it, so your retina is actually perceiving that image upside down. And then through 10 layers, your retina then perceives that light. That light has to go through 10 layers before it gets to your optic disc. Then it goes back into your brain through the optic chiasm. It switches places, and then it goes to the back of your head, where all of a sudden these electrical signals that are registered by rods and cones are then translated into an image. And 90% of the information that comes into our body comes from that system. Now I ask myself, is there any way that we can produce a model by which, in stepwise, incremental, random fashion, this eye came about through random processes of chaos and time? I would say if the chance even remotely exists, it's very remote. That's just the eye. Then we take a look at the kidney, and we understand that the kidney exists in various gradients in order to function as it does. If your kidney doesn't work, what are you going to do? You're going to ultimately enter into end-stage renal disease and die. Unless you have a dialysis machine, you're going to die. That's one function. Your heart, how does your heart function? It has to contract in perfect timing. Otherwise, you'll have atrial fibrillation or VTAC, and all of a sudden your body can't be supplied by blood, and you will die yet again. And you have various levels of depolarization happening in the heart here in order for it to contract the way it does. If for some reason your body gets severed of an electrical signal from your brain to your heart has a redundant system, a pacemaker, in order to take care of itself. And we just looked at three systems. And I look at system after system after system after system like this, and I think, what is the best answer for this? And if my conclusion is random processes, okay, I have a problem. I am leaning on what I would think is faith that God does not exist. Because the best explanation for all this, to me, appears to be God. Now, others might say, no, it's not. But then we look at some other issues in life. For example, the existence of sentience, the fact that we can know the world around us. The existence of a conscience, the ability that we have to communicate. The fine-tuning of this universe. We look at the fact that Aristotle, as he said, the universe requires an unmoved mover. No matter what that is, at some point, something began this universe. And the fact of the matter is, just like was said a few moments ago, just yesterday in USA Today, we see this article about the gravitational microwaves being discovered in the universe, indicating yet again that the universe had a beginning. Well, what is the universe made of? The universe is made of time. It's made of matter. It's made of energy. So whatever caused this universe had to be outside of time. It had to be eternal. Whatever caused this universe had to be outside of space. It had to be omnipresent. It had to be outside of energy. It had to be omnipotent. So just by looking at the fact that the universe began, we can conclude that there was an eternal, omnipotent, omnipresent creator. So we're looking from all these various perspectives, and we're saying time after time again, the best explanation is God. And I can find some other explanation for morality. I can find some other explanation, although it's really hard. I can find some other explanation for the origins of life, no matter how implausible it is. I can come up with some kind of model in order to explain the eye, even though there's not one that's been proven at all. But if I'm going to use Occam's razor, as is often proffered, one explanation covers it all, and that's God. So I don't want to come at the question from just this angle of why does it matter that we have hope? Why does it matter that we have meaning and purpose? I would first want to say we have plenty of other reason to conclude that God exists as well. But now to your question. If you do a little bit of background on me, you'll realize I was ordained Southern Baptist. I'm also Middle Eastern by background, so what that means is when it's time to preach, we throw the clock out the window. So I'll try to keep it brief. I saw when I was in medical school is when I became a Christian. I wasn't raised with this faith. I didn't come easily by this faith. I had to give up everything I ever loved in order to embrace this faith. And I didn't do it because someone told me I would go to heaven. I didn't do it because someone told me that this is the way I would feel good about myself. In Islam, I felt fine. I felt that I had a relationship with my Creator, whatever that meant. I felt that I would go to heaven if God had mercy on me. So I didn't take those end goals and say, this is why I'm going to accept Christianity. I studied the evidence to see whether or not this man Jesus died on the cross and rose from the dead and claimed to be God. And if he did those three things, which would have happened in history, historically this man, did he die? Historically this man, did he rise? Historically this man, did he claim to be God? If he did all three of those things, then Christianity would have a strong case to be true. And that's why I was willing to say to my mother and to my father, even though you have loved me your entire lives and you've poured everything into me, I'm now going to embrace the one faith that's going to make you feel like I'm betraying you. I'm going to take that one step which is going to make you be as debased amongst our friends as you could possibly be. It had to be worth it for me, and it was the evidence that did it, not some feel-good nature. But after I became a Christian, I took a look at the college students, I'm sorry, the medical students who were around me, and I saw something going on, and not just in them, but in the residents and the attending physicians as well. What I saw was people who were going regularly through the mill, just running the rat race, going through the motions. They had been taught their whole life that success meant to get as much money as possible, to have as much of an inheritance as possible for their children, and to be as physically fit as possible, perhaps to marry someone, a spouse who looks attractive. That's what success means. And I saw friend after friend after friend achieving all these measures of success. And yet the look of hollowness in their eyes only grew deeper and deeper. And the fact of the matter is, history testifies to the fact that you do not get fulfillment, you do not get meaning from any naturalistic model, any sort of material gain, any sort of achievement in your life. You get it from two things, and this is actually a study that was conducted in Harvard and Yale in 2004, I believe. A professor there said that, it was a joint study, a professor said that human beings are hardwired to worship God. Human beings are hardwired to worship God. Now explain that one evolutionarily to me. It doesn't quite work. So for one, to answer your question, that's how we're hardwired. But for two, when you start taking this meaning and purpose out of the equation, when you start taking God out of the equation, our society begins to involute and collapse. We were just talking about Joseph Mengele a few minutes ago. We're talking about the fact that children were castrated for the sake of experiment. Women were scalped for the sake of experiment. Mengele, what he used to do is he used to take children and sit them on a table and not let them move, and he would watch how long it would take them to die from not being fed. He used to take grown men and put them outside at various temperatures in order to calculate how long it takes them to die at various exposures to the elements. You see, when you take the value of human life out of the equation, when you take meaning out of the equation, then all we become is purposeless lumps of carbon. All we become is meaningless byproducts of the universe and time and chance. And so you can stick somebody outside to die to see how long it takes in order to satisfy your academic curiosity or perhaps for the supposed greater good of helping your nation. Because what do they mean? They mean nothing. Yet our hearts testify to the fact that our neighbors mean something, that love is real. And so to answer your question, I would say there's plenty of evidence to say that God does exist, that our bodies are hardwired to have that kind of meaning. And third, when we take that kind of meaning out of the equation, our society involutes and we become a civilization of monsters. I hope that answers your question.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Nabil.
Let's take a question from this side.
Good evening, Dr. Zacharias and Dr. Nabil. It's a great honor to have you here tonight with us. For about 6 or 7 years now, me and my friends have been going out evangelizing in the streets. And I'm sorry to change gears here, but I'm in desperate need of your help tonight. We encounter a lot of groups on the streets, religious groups, Mormons, Jehovah's Witnesses, things like that. And one group we have a particular problem with sometimes in answering is Roman Catholicism. And so I went back to research Martin Luther and Charles Spurgeon and things like that, and they would call it a heresy. But when I fast forward to now, and I go and read The Kingdom of the Occults by Walter Martin, it's not in there. So my question to you is Roman Catholicism another example of how unity does not equal uniformity within the Christian community, or is it at its core a derivative from true Christianity?
Nabil did say he's like
saying,
Baptist,
just like saying, do you want to be axed or do you want to be hanged, you know? I appreciate the question that you're raising. You know, it's interesting that when you grow up in a land of India where there are 330 million deities, you get a lot of questions like this as well. So let me issue a disclaimer here briefly. We as Christian apologists basically defend the biblical worldview as we understand it, see it, and find it represented. We know there are many people who may have some doctrinal diversities and doctrinal differences from us, and we understand that. So you've obviously heard me address this in some way, because you use the very words I've sometimes used. Unity does not have to be uniformity, so something like that. Let me put it to you in these words without getting specific in the answer and then issuing one or two comments after that. Number one, it is this. It doesn't really matter what label one puts on an empty bottle, if the bottle is empty, or if the bottle is mislabeled, then it is even very dangerous. The Bible reminds us who is a Christian. It is one who really confesses in his mouth and believes in his heart that Jesus Christ is Lord and that Christ has raised him from the dead, and so on. When you get into this theological realm, there are many other additions that come in. So if you ask me, what does it take to be a follower of Jesus Christ? My answer may be very brief. If you say to me, what does it take to belong to a particular denomination? We may make it longer because the denomination may add its distinctives to find uniformity in that group. Then you may say, what does it take to teach in a theological institution? Now you have to be even more protracted in your answer, because as an instructor, you have to be theologically very correct, crossing your T's and dotting your I's. I know many people, whether they are in Protestantism or in Roman Catholicism, who are truly followers of Jesus Christ. There are many other aspects of their faith that they may not fully subscribe to, that is an accretion across history that was added by the power of leadership or by the power of group or sectarianism. The fascinating thing is, prior to the Reformation, we were all sort of divided into Eastern and Western at that point, and there were distinctives and hierarchy, and then doctrinal distinctives emerged just as well. So my answer to you is, what is a cult? Let me define it for you in the simplest possible way. A cult is generally, I think, Walter, I actually, as you probably know, went on and became the general editor of Walter Martin's book. So in the last 7 or 8 years, that book, the family asked me to bring the editing into it. But I define a cult this way. Anything that deviates from the historic person and work of Jesus Christ, or adds to his teaching, and is generally at the instruction of one individual who dictates that belief, it is almost certainly cultic at that time. Oftentimes, groups can function as a hierarchy within themselves and an individual heteronomically dictating the laws. If that happens, then any one of us, whether in Protestantism or in Catholicism, can end up becoming cultic by following just one particular brand of teaching and deviating from the historic person and work of Jesus Christ. My answer to you is very simple. You follow Christ as best you know how, as revealed in the Word of God, and serve him and love him and honor him with your life and your heart and in your walk. And that's what you preach to others as well. God will be the ultimate judge of what groups went wrong in which direction. I have a hard enough time dictating whether my family has been right in every way, leave alone historic 500-600 years of denominations. So I'm not dodging the question. I'm just telling you it is wise to be careful and not tar everybody with the same brush in a particular group. The faith that you have in Christ is a personal one, and sometimes I know people who stay within groups in order to bring changes within that group where they see doctrinally they have deviated or gone astray from other belief systems. It is possible that a person may be a good Christian and a bad Roman Catholic. It can easily happen that way.
To draw another question from the Twitter stream, we had several versions of a question related to how do we connect the God that we see in the Old Testament with the God of love that we see portrayed in the New Testament. Many times we see what seems to be a conflict between the character of God. Okay. Can you address that?
I'll let you take the next one here. Is there a conflict in the character between the Old Testament presentation of God and the New Testament version of the love of Christ? And the answer to that is no, there isn't. There is just the appearance. In fact, let me give you a classic example of this. When you go to the Old Testament, there's the book of Hosea. Hosea is a prophet, and he's a pastor, and he's married to a woman called Gomer, who becomes a prostitute. Three children are born in this home, and God commands Hosea to go and love this woman, beloved of her adulterers, and to buy her back at half the price of a slave and a day's rations. It is one of the most powerful expressions of God's love for humanity in that book of that we call the Minor Prophet of Hosea. If you look entirely at the book of Exodus and Deuteronomy, the law is expressed to build a nation, but grace, love, and forgiveness are replete through all of its pages. There is no distinction between the God of the Old Testament and the God of the New. In Christ, the law was fulfilled. The law is still just as much a representation of God's person and God's character and God's will. But the difference is that he reminds us again and again that by law, none of us will ultimately attain salvation. And here's a distinction I want to give. And going back to the gentleman's question who talked about, you know, the feeling and all of that, the issue of the Christian faith is, as Nabil said, a historic Christian faith. In fact, many times the claims of the Christian faith upon my life don't make me feel good. I feel worse because of it. So you really don't go in the direction of feeling. You go in the direction of that which is right and that which is the ought. When you go to the Old Testament, you see the sequence that is followed. First, you see them redeemed out of Egypt. Then you see the moral law given, and then you see the tabernacle erected. This is always the sequence, Old or New Testament, redemption, righteousness, and worship. It is not just chronological, it is also logical. You cannot be righteous until you are first redeemed. You cannot worship until you are first redeemed and righteous. For who shall ascend unto the hill of the Lord but he that hath clean hands and a pure heart? First redemption, then the moral law righteousness, then worship. This was the sequence in the Old Testament. Now, the Bible makes it very clear, old and new, that Jesus Christ did not come into this world to make bad people good. He came into this world to make dead people live. The issue is this, that morality alone cannot change your life and mine. The uniqueness of the Christian faith lies here. And I analyze any worldview, any religious worldview, any pantheistic worldview, and you talk to a Muslim and you ask him, how does one attain paradise? He will candidly tell you with the firm belief and legitimate belief in his worldview that your good deeds will have to outweigh your bad deeds on that judgment day, and that's how you attain paradise. You ask a Hindu, how do you attain moksha or nirvana? Through every birth is a rebirth, every life is a payment for the previous life. The cyclical pattern of karma goes on and on and on till all of the bill is ultimately paid and you attain moksha, release, or nirvana, the extinguishing of that self. You ask a Christian, how do you attain eternal life? And the answer is very simple. by the grace of God, with the love of God, and the forgiveness of God, an unmerited favor that God gives to you and me. It is the only worldview where you do not earn your salvation, but your salvation is a gift to you from God Himself. Let me illustrate this for you. Let me illustrate this for you. In the most incredibly popular story of the New Testament, Jesus stuns his audience with the ending of that story. Stuns them. You must know this is an Eastern way of telling a story. And so here's the young lad who says, I want to treat you as if you are dead. Give me what rightly belongs to me, and I want it to my name, and I want to leave home. I want out of here. The father gives him all of that, and he says he goes up, squanders it, spends it, ends up in a pigsty. And finally says, even in the servants in my father's house are better off than I am. He turns around and makes his way back. The shocking aspect of that story, if you were an Easterner, is not that he's making his way back to the house, but before he enters the house, the father leaves the house and runs towards him to embrace him and welcome him back. You ask any Easterner here whether their father would have done that. The father would want you to come, literally fall at the feet. It would be a high penitence for the father to give up his dignity and run outside and bring that son back. Is not the way it would have been done. When you wrong your parents, you come back and you pay your dues. In the prodigal son's story, the father leaves the home when he hears the son is on his way, wraps his arms around him, and welcomes him back. Henry Nouwen, who was professor at Harvard, went to the Hermitage Museum. I'd been there. And he looked at the Rembrandt painting of the father embracing the son and spent hours in front of it. It changed his entire life. He came back to Harvard, resigned his position, and went on to work with the mentally challenged in Toronto till the day he passed away. The loving father who comes to welcome the young boy, and the one who lived by the law is angry with all that happens. The Old and the New Testament tell the same story. It is the loving father who pursues and brings you back to himself. It's a story of love and grace and a demonstration that law will never get us there. Our problem is not that we are immoral. Our problem is that we are spiritually dead, and God alone is big enough for our redemption. That's the answer.
We'll take a question from over here.
Yeah. Thank you for taking my question. I'm a philosophy student, and I'm also a Christian with a huge interest in apologetics and theology and whatnot. But my question comes from Colossians 2, where he says, "Do not be taken captive by philosophy and empty deceit." And I'm reminded of another quote by Nietzsche, where he says, "If gods or God were really to exist, how could my mind stand not being one of them?" And so my question is, what do you think the role or the importance of philosophy is in the pursuit of truth today? Is it limited to its historical contributions in metaphysics and logic and reasoning and what we can take from that and apply to our worldviews now? Or is there something more that we can employ to find the truth about God? Because I love philosophy and I hate philosophy at the same time, because it's man's best effort at finding the truth. Biology, the sciences, physics, all of that originated in philosophy. And man, like you were explaining about biology and the human body, it's just amazing the depth that we've been able to discover and glorify God in. But at the same time, I hate it because that's man's best effort at finding the truth. And therefore, we need Christ and we need the glory of God and the grace of God to bring us about and shine the light in that. But my question is, is there a role, is there a significant part for philosophy to play in the pursuit of truth?
Absolutely. Yes, indeed. I had a professor of philosophy who did his work at Loyola, and he's written about 80 books. And when he'd finished a 5,000-page manuscript, He was telling me, he said his wife finished reading it in order to edit it and called him into the room and said, Norm, I want to ask you a question, and I promise you if you tell me the truth, I won't tell anybody. Did even you understand what you have written in here? Lee Strobel, the author, phoned me one day and said, I'm going to blame you because my son's gone into philosophy. And I was so shocked. I called my son and I said, son, do you know the difference between a professor of philosophy and a large pizza? And he said, what's the joke, Dad? He said, do you know the difference between a professor of philosophy and a large pizza? He said, what's the joke? He said, not a joke, it's a reality. He said, a large pizza can feed a family of four. So, if you go into philosophy, you really are going to go into that thin air of the cerebrally driven people. I personally love it. I've enjoyed it. When you take the big three in the writings of Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle, and you come right down through history and go through the medieval philosophers, where you're kind of studying Aquinas, and frankly, I've done a lot of work in Eastern philosophies. You study reading Shankara, Ramanuja, and some of them, Swami Vivekananda. I love dabbling in it. But just remember, when you're dealing with the life's real issues and the confluence that the disciplines must have, there are five that you have to deal with. God, which is theology, knowledge, which is epistemology, reality, which is metaphysics, empiricism, which is the sciences, and morality, which is ethics. God, knowledge, reality, empirical sciences, and morality, ethics. These five disciplines ultimately come together in order to give you the expression of how you know what truth really is. Once that comes together from a rich moral soil, emerges the finest of the artistic expressions. I think this is where the arts bloom and blossom. When moral reasoning, when the moral soil is rich, the arts can emerge in fantastic and fabulous and creative ways. When the moral soil is poor and rotten, then art becomes deviant, and ultimately humanity is dragged down the drain along with artistic deviance and so on. Art is a beautiful thing through the eye gate, through the ear gate, whether it's the performing arts or the fine arts. You have to recognize the beauty that art has given to the world. You can walk through museums, you can listen to strains of music, and I think one of the best artistic expressions is in the music of Phantom of the Opera, where you watch the story, you know, of what hideousness does and how it is blocked off and how there is still even beauty that can be seen in the genius that arises out of all of that. So the arts are intrinsically tied to these five disciplines, because from these art emerges as a worldview and as a legitimate expression. God, theology, knowledge, epistemology, you've got reality, metaphysics, you've got the sciences in empiricism, and you've got morality in ethics. So philosophy has a vital role to play, but in grabbing the finger of philosophy, you do not grab the fist of reality. There are many other that have to come to bear upon it. That's why, by the way, the Greeks created universities. Why? Because they were looking for the answer to unity in diversity. In the diversity of the disciplines, you had to find the unity of truth and the unity of expression. And so even to go back to that difficult question of various groups and various denominations and various sectarian things, ultimately you have to go back to the truth. Who is Jesus? What did he say? What did he teach? And if he indeed conforms to the truth and reality, he becomes the one we follow, not ultimately a denominational group or a discipline. The discipline has to come under the service of Almighty God, who's given you the head and the heart. And Archbishop William Temple said, the longest journey in life is between the head and the heart. So bridge the two. Okay.
Thank you so much.
Unfortunately, we are running out of time, but let's take one more question from this side, and then we'll
Hello.
Conclude there.
Dr. Zacharias and Dr. Qureshi, I'd like to express my gratitude for y'all coming out here and your busy schedules. You're a great influence in many of my friends and I's lives. And the question is for Robbie. What are your views on open theism? For instance, the story of Jonah, when God said that he was going to destroy the city, and the city repented, and God changed his mind through that. What are your thoughts on that?
He's here. Nabil has done a lot of work in this field, I know. Of course, Boyd from Bethel came out big on this issue of open theism, and then the issue of middle knowledge and all comes in. I think William Lane Craig's middle knowledge. Nabil does a marvelous job. After he finishes, I'll just give it a footnote and bring it to a close. But I think his expertise in this will truly address and answer your question. Nabil, go ahead.
If that were anybody else, I would say he's stalling. But he's had 42 years to think about this, so I know he's not. Thank you so much for the question that was addressed to him. I'm honored to field it.
Why don't you define open theism?
So the idea of, you've got basically two ends of the spectrum on free will versus predestination. On the one end is kind of a hard fatalism. Everything you do has been pre-decided. You have no actual say in the matter. Every single choice you possibly could make has been decided from beforehand by God or by some other force. I actually think that naturalism, when you take God out of the equation, ends up looking extremely fatalistic. All you are is a group of molecules. You're the process of physics combined with chemistry and biology and mathematics, and all this combined decides everything your brain thinks. So I think from a naturalistic model, it's fairly fatalistic because you don't really think. Your brain more or less fizzes. It doesn't actually think. So you've got one end of the spectrum. On the other end of the spectrum, you have something like open theism. On this view, God has created the universe, but he doesn't quite know what's going to happen. He gives moral agents free will, and he lets them choose what they want to do with their lives. And he can, because of their choices, then they really, in order to have true free will, they have their own choices to make. And God doesn't quite know what's going to happen at the end of it in extreme degree of detail. My personal view on this matter, open theism, there are some people who have defended it well. I do not take it as my prerogative to tell people whether or not they are Christian or non-Christian, whether they fall into realms of heresy or not. So I'm not going to impugn anyone who's a Christian who's taken the open theist standpoint. Personally, I could never sustain that. I could never defend that from within a catalog of choices of the spectrum of free will. I think that the greatest explanation for free will, and in fact, in my mind, this makes God into this amazing orchestrator, coordinator of the universe. You can have God saying, you will do this, or you can have God saying, I don't know what's going to happen, but in the middle comes this amazing orchestra of God giving people free will and also determining the outcome of the universe. It's a view called Molinism, and as Dr. Zacharias just said, it's brilliantly explained by William Lane Craig, professor from Talbot, who currently lives in Atlanta. The view is this: God knows us so intimately and so well, he knows what choices we are going to make given our circumstances. So he knows us very well, and he knows what choices we're going to make given our circumstances. Now, my bride, she's a beautiful woman. She takes excellent care of herself. She served in the Coast Guard for 9 years. She only eats healthy food, much to my chagrin. So I know this about her. So if I were to say to her, Michelle, where do you want to go for dinner tonight? We can choose Panera or McDonald's. RZIM does not endorse either restaurant, just, I don't know the legalities here. But if I said to her, we can go to Panera or McDonald's, I know she would choose Panera. So now imagine I have plans for her already set up for when she arrives at Panera, because I knew her so well, I knew she was going to go there, there's a surprise party waiting for her. Now someone could say to me, Nabil, did you limit her free will? I'll say, no, I knew what she was going to freely choose, and so I planned accordingly. Now, what God does, I think, from this view of Molinism, is he has this middle knowledge of what we will choose given our circumstances, and so he creates us, and like Acts chapter 17 says, he places us in specific times and places, knowing what we're going to do, to orchestrate then, through our free will, through everyone's free will, his intended and desired outcomes. It's this amazing marriage of him giving us choice, partnering, allowing us to partner with him, while still being the sovereign creator of the universe. Fascinating stuff. So that's my position. Now, before Uncle comes and fixes whatever I said that was wrong, I want to just briefly address this audience, because it was in the university when I decided to start looking into, because of the injunctions from my friend, Nabil, you need to know why you believe what you believe. You need to be able to defend your faith. It was at the university when I realized just how important all these questions are, just how important this question is. What are you going to do? If you have free will, what are you going to do with it? How are you going to choose your life, to live your life? And so many people around me were constantly attacked and assailed and assaulted by this idea that the reason why they're here is to be a consumer. You are here to buy an iPad. You are here to listen to Miley Cyrus or Justin Bieber or whoever. Hopefully not. You're here to listen to this. You're here to purchase this. That's what you are here to do. And quite frankly, you can choose to live the life of a consumer, but I'm telling you, God has created you, according to the Christian worldview, to be someone who is not just a consumer, but a world changer. See, the Christian message is this, that God was willing to die in order to love us and to make a way for us. Now, who were we at that time? We were His enemies. We were people rebelling against Him. We were people sinning against Him. This is according to the Christian worldview. We were sinners and rebellious against Him, yet He loved us to the point where He was willing to die for us. And then He tells us to follow Him. Now imagine for just one moment if we used our free will, our choice to follow Him and to live as He lived. You know, the Christian message tells us that we don't have to worry about our afterlife. As a lot of people, a lot of my friends, my cousins, as Muslims, they're constantly thinking, what do I need to do in order to get into heaven? Or not necessarily that overtly, but they're thinking, what's right in this situation? What's right in this situation? What will please God in this situation? And the ultimate hope is to maybe get into heaven. In the Christian worldview, you've been secured that ahead of time, so you don't have to focus your paradigm on what do I need to do to please Him. You can focus your paradigm on what can I do to serve all those around me. What can I do in order to live for others, even die for others, in order to follow my God? That's why God tells us in Matthew, through the Sermon on the Mount, He says, don't worry about what food you're going to eat. Don't the birds of the air get food. Don't worry about the clothes you're going to wear. Don't even the lilies of the field get clothed in greater splendor than Solomon. Don't worry about those things. Yes, He says that, but He says that in conjunction with this. If your enemy is hungry, give them something to eat. If your neighbor is naked, give them some clothes to wear. It's not just don't worry about what you have. It's then give what you have to others, because that's what God has done for you. And so in following God then, in using our ability to choose, I think, freely in order to make these kinds of decisions, we were created from before time for a specific purpose to impact the world around us and to be world changers. And don't let anyone ever tell you that you're not beautiful enough, or that you're not strong enough, or that you're not handsome enough, you don't make enough money, you're not smart enough. You have been created to change the world. God knew from the beginning of time that you were going to be like this. He loved you anyway, was willing to die for you. Here you are. How are you going to use this security and this identity in God? So I'm very glad you asked this question on free will and determinism. Let's take that question and then apply it in our own lives for the sake of the gospel.
Okay. Thank you.
We'll bring this evening to a close. I'm awfully sorry there are some of you still standing here. I tell you what, we normally can't afford to do this. We are traveling so much. In fact, tomorrow morning we are off to Anchorage, Alaska. I'm speaking at the governor's prayer breakfast over the weekend, and the next on to Uppsala University in Sweden, working at different subjects. My voice is also beginning to give way. I've just been keeping a very heavy pace. So let me make it personal. Why do I do this? I'm 67 now, and it'd be very easy to hang it all up and say, I've done my bit. It's the younger one's turn now, and I'll move on. Two things. I love my God very dearly in the person of Christ, and I believe Him to be the truth. It is not just because I find feeling and origin, meaning, morality, and destiny, but truth is also historically verified. truth is testified to in the scriptures. You can see the prophetic scheme and all of that. You can go through the arguments of the existence of God, and then on the heels of that, experience follows as verification. But secondly, I have to say to you, I'm deeply troubled over what I see happening in North America. We're in trouble as a nation. We're really in trouble as a nation. All that we are seeing happening fiscally is only symptomatic of the moral structures and the values that we have abandoned along the way. The value of human life, our reasoning, our moral boundaries, every one of those things have changed. And when I come to a university such as this, I want to say to you, you have such a unique privilege of being in one of the great schools of the world. There are millions and millions of students who would love to have been here but will never make it. You are privileged to be in an outstanding university of this caliber. I can tell you this, at your age, I wouldn't have made it entering in here. I would have failed. Recently, I spoke at India's premier medical school and I told them, I failed the entrance there. I just had no desire to study. And now God has a sense of humor and takes me back as a guest speaker. I just want to say to you, as young students of this university, think through carefully, what is life all about? Who are you as a person? How are you going to raise your family? What values are you going to give your children? How are you going to govern your lives? What lines will you not cross? What boundaries will you erase? What fences will you remove? G.K. Chesterton said, God is like the sun. Without him, you can't look at it, but without it, you can't look at anything else. So when you go from causality to design to experience, you see his fingerprint everywhere. I want to close with a parable and this quotation. When I was a youngster growing up in Delhi and then becoming a fan of a lot of Western music, one of the great groups was called the Kingston Trio. And the Kingston Trio used to sing a song called Desert Pete. It's about a man going through the desert, using up all the bottles of water, and he is getting thirsty and the water is gone. He thinks he's going to be finished, but he sees a pump in the middle, and that pump looks ready to be primed, but when he gets there, it's dry, metal upon metal. He's not going to get any water. But he notices a tin can around it, and in the tin can is a piece of paper. It says, Dear traveler, don't despair. I'll tell you how to get water. Under the nozzle, beneath the sand, there should be a bottle of water. It should be full. You'll find it burrowing down a little. Don't drink it. Pour it out into the cylinder, prime your pump with the other hand, the suction system will begin to work, water will come gushing out, refill all your bottles, don't forget to fill up that one bottle and put it back. Warning, you're going to be tempted to disbelieve this note and consume that one bottle because you're holding it very close to your hand right now. Don't do it. You will soon be thirsty and so will everybody else who passes by. Empty it out as instructed and you will have all the water you want for your journey ahead. Signed, Desert Pete. You're at a crossroads in life often. I'm at a crossroads. The temptation is, are you going to consume it upon yourself? And then walk away empty and say, why did I do that? Or are you going to be wise enough to pour it out into the hands of your Creator and let Him fill you and give you that drink of living water, so that you will never be thirsty anymore? Beyond that, you will find the perpetual novelty in Him. If you don't know Christ, my suggestion is this: go back and just start reading the Gospel of John. Write all of your questions in the margin. Begin with a simple prayer. Jesus, if you are who you claim to be, reveal yourself to me, and I will trust you. And I trust and pray that with a sincere heart, you will mean it. I am so honored when a university like this invites me to come. I'm really not worthy of it. In fact, I often tell my wife, why? Why am I even heading there? But I do know this, that God in His design has a time and an appointment. And so I'm honored that you asked me, and I thank you for giving me your attention. I want to close with this Canadian writer, Douglas Copeland, who writes his book, Life After God. This group coming from Western Canada that walks away from God, abandons all values, and the years go by, and he wants to evaluate what happened to him and he ends his book with these words. Now, here is my secret. I tell you with an openness of heart that I doubt I shall ever achieve again. So I pray you are in a quiet room as you hear my words. My secret is this: I really need God. I am sick, and I can no longer make it alone. I need God to help me give because I no longer seem capable of giving, to help me be kind as I no longer seem capable of even kindness, to help me love as I seem beyond being able to love. Douglas Copeland. Here is my secret. I need God. So do you, so do I. And in the person of Christ, we have found that revelation. May God bless you here at A&M. I wish you every success, and I hope our paths will cross again sometime. For Nabil and me, it's been an honor to be here. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Pastor. Thank you. Thank you.